This is Neil Aitkenhead, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Alden Lee on the 21st of October 2009.
My name is Neil Aitkenhead, and I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne.
When?
In 1936. Do you want the exact date? 11th of January 1936.
Okay. Yeah. And education, Neil? What was your main place of education?
Well, my main place of education was the Royal Grammar School at Newcastle. having been to various... I was evacuated during the war, informally, to my live with an auntie in the middle of Northumberland. So I went to the village school to start with, which was, and also to a prep school before going to the Royal Grammar School.
And the university or college?
I was at the local university as well. I lived at home with mother and went to university locally in Newcastle, King's College, which was then part of the University of Durham.
And so you are a dyed-in-the-wool Geordie, are you?
Why aye, man. Why aye?
But you have to put the accent on, don't you? You haven't got a natural Geordie.
Well,
accent.
Some people detect a slight accent, but yes, that's true.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic, either hearing about it or reading about it? What was your first memory?
Well, at university, at King's College, we had a member of staff of the geography department who'd just come back from the Trans-Antarctic expedition. He was called Hal Lister, and he was glaciologist with Sir Vivian Fuchs on the Trans-Antarctic expedition of 1957, I think it was. And he really was the person who encouraged me to apply and so on. But I had always fancied myself, I think, shall we say, as a sort of polar explorer. You know, I used to go out in winter in the snow and tie a sledge to myself and plod off into the snow, imagining I was being something.
Can you remember where that inspiration came from? Was it books or...?
I think it must have been books, yes. I didn't personally know anybody at that stage who had been to polar regions. I was the youngest of four children. I had two elder brothers, but I don't think either of them inspired me particularly. I mean, they took me out camping and encouraged me in the outdoor life, but not necessarily polar.
So the demise of Captain Scott didn't put you off then? You were happy to go and discover the South Pole in Northumberland?
Yes. Yes, and then at university I joined the University Exploration Society. And I also went on expeditions with an organisation called the Braithe Exploration Group.
Say again?
Braithe Exploration Group, which was centred in at Braithe Hall in the near Keswick in the Lake District. And I went with them whilst, was it my first year at university or between school and university? I went with them to Norway and camped on the Jostedalsbrae ice cap just north of Sognefjord in Norway. And that obviously was all part of the process of getting to like that sort of life. Yeah.
So you had some quite early training in coping with
yes,
polar conditions.
Yes. I used to like climbing and modest rock climbing and climbing to the summits of mountains, yeah. So not just rock climbing for the sort of gymnastic point of view. And so it followed on quite naturally from those experiences, yes.
How did geology appear in your life?
Well, one of my two brothers was a geologist, so I knew what it was all about. And obviously geology is something which takes you to the outdoors, or usually does, and it seemed to be a subject which would, with a lifestyle, I suppose, as I imagined it, which would suit me very well. And again, I was able to study geology both at the sixth form in school and get an A-level, and at the local university, with the same teachers, it happened. The chap who, one of our lecturers at university, also taught A-level at the school I went to. So
what was his name?
It was Douglas Robson, who was a bit of an eccentric character, but...
In what way?
Oh, in what way? He liked practical jokes, and you never quite knew where you were with him because of his practical jokiness. But he was obviously an encouraging person, yeah.
You applied to FIDS pretty much straight away after university, didn't you?
Yes, yes.
So that was always the ground plan?
I think it must have been, yes. I can't really remember, apart from this chap Hal Lister at university, actually meeting or knowing anybody who'd already been to FIDS. So I say it was Hal Lister who was encouraging me to do that, yes. Yeah.
What do you recall of the interview process? Was it rigorous, shall we say?
I thought it was remarkably easy, actually. it didn't seem to be at all a difficult experience, as far as I can remember. You know, I almost felt they'd chosen me regardless of interview. Yeah.
Your name was already on the ship passenger list, was it?
Well, no, I don't know about that, but certainly it didn't seem to be a great obstacle, the interview. Yeah.
Do you recall who was on the interview panel?
Only by really thinking of who was on the interview. You know, obviously Ray Adie was my boss when I joined, and he was certainly on the interview panel, as presumably was the man in charge of personnel at FIDS.
This is Bill Sloman.
Bill Sloman. Ah, that's a point. My brother happened to know Bill Sloman because he lived at Harpenden, where my brother was working in the Ministry of Agriculture plant pathology lab. So I already knew one of the key people, I suppose you could say, in the organisation. Whether that was any advantage, I don't know.
I'm intrigued that they would choose graduates rather than experienced geologists. Do you have any idea, in retrospect, why they were taking freshers?
No, I don't. I think they presumably wanted people who didn't have too many home ties. Although there was the odd married person was recruited, they mostly chose people who were unattached bachelors. And I suppose they simply felt that, you know, we were keen and fresh and fit and fitted the bill in that way, yeah.
Were you aware of any psychological probing that went on to make sure you were a stable chap?
Not aware of it, no. I'd read about the sort of interviews that other organisations do, particularly the Americans with their Rorschach ink blot tests and these sort of things. But I was hardly aware of being probed, really, when I, as far as I can remember from the interview.
Yeah. That makes sense, yes.
Yes.
Was there much of a gap between being told you were going south and actually leaving?
Yes, we had a so-called course at Birmingham University under Ray Adie. And this course consisted of being sat at a table with the other new recruits, about three or four others in geology, and being given a pile of polar books to read. And we just spent week after week after week doing this.
Reading?
Yeah, I'll be reading or sleeping. And as a course, I think it was a bit of a travesty, really, because, you know, we shortly afterwards, they decided to start giving people training in rope techniques and crevasse rescue and practical important things like that, but in my day, that
in
hadn't started.
In 1959, that wasn't the case?
No, yeah. No.
What did you make of Ray Adie? You must have come across him several times over your time.
Well, he was a rather difficult person, in that he was very stiff upper lip and quite not particularly approachable or easy to get on with. Mostly because, probably looking back, because he himself was not particularly secure with with the people he had, he was in charge of. But
How do you mean?
Well, I think he was just, as I say, rather difficult to get to know on a personal basis. He almost put himself on a pedestal, I would say. Mm. But you know, that was him, and that was how we accepted him. He used to remind us a lot that Sir Vivian Fuchs was the boss, and obviously he was very sort of subservient to Sir Vivian Fuchs, or felt subservient. Made Sir Vivian Fuchs to be a bit of a martinet, I would say. And that was, I suppose, subsequently, that term was used for Sir Vivian Fuchs since after the Transantarctic Expedition. Yeah.
Did you meet him at all yourself, Fuchs?
Only very formally and on a that sort of basis, yes.
So when you left for the Antarctic, did you feel prepared, unprepared, marginally prepared?
I think marginally prepared, yes. Yes, simply through this lack of practical experience of the techniques we might be expected to use when we got there. But I think the system of 1 year, 2 years, people going for 2 years, two winters, and staying so that the people who came in had people who'd already a year's experience to train them. It was quite a good system, looking back.
Because
we had this these experienced people to show us the ropes and guide us in our techniques and so on. Despite the, as I said, the lack of practicalities back home in the so-called course before we left.
So when you arrived, was there an immediate training process down south, or did you just pick things up as you went along?
You picked things up as you went along, oh yes.
So yes. The trick was to not get killed in the first few weeks, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, that's right. No, I think we, I mean, my first sledge journey was spent, it seemed now, about 95% lying in my sleeping bag in cloud and snow. With Chris Brading, who was with us this week, just waiting for Chris to be able to use his theodolite to sight onto the next trig point, as it were. And so I read more novels in those 6 weeks or so than I've ever read before or since.
So was that a disappointment then when you got down there and found yourself and forcibly laid up for such a long time?
I don't think it was disappointing. No, I just accepted it as a fact of life. Yeah. I don't think I had any particular expectations in that line.
Had you been given a work brief, or had you created your own?
The only briefing really was to map as much as possible as the weather and circumstances permitted. It was very vague.
So you weren't even pointed north, south, east or west?
No, you were just given a blank map and told to fill in the geology, really. Looking back, I mean, I can't remember those words being used, obviously, but that's in effect what it was, yes. We had some guidance in that the area immediately around Hope Bay had already been done, and reconnaissance geological survey had been done by sledge parties going down the northern end of the Antarctic Peninsula. But it was just the main route south, little bits of rock outcrop on that route that had really been visited. Nobody had sort of penetrated up the glaciers and looked at the rock exposures, which were away from this highway down the Prince Gustav Channel. So, I was looking back, I was very lucky to get a bit of virgin country to geologically survey.
So you were treading where no man had trodden.
Absolutely, yes.
A blank piece of paper can be a threat or an opportunity, can't it?
Yes, yes.
Which way do you see it? Because you really are starting from scratch.
Well, the frustrations due to the weather were such that when an opportunity did come of looking at rocks and doing geology, you were very, very pleased to take that opportunity and get on with it. So there was a sort of built-in incentive to get on with it when the weather allowed you to. And it rarely became irksome having to go out every day, and from especially in the summer months when there was almost 24 hours of daylight. So one was entirely really one's own boss, and in terms of the geological work being done, clearly it was the base leader's job to provide the backup in terms of personnel and dog teams, which we then used. In other words, to organise things so that you could do the maximum amount of geological surveying. And on the whole, that succeeded, I think. Mm. It was just mainly this dreadful weather that was the big hindrance.
So how did you decide in the end what to do first? Did you have complete choice?
Yes.
What was your thinking about where to go first?
Well, I was really part of the process of learning how to do it. I mean, learning how to dog sledge and camp and survive in that meant that you went out with experienced people who were, in my case, were surveyors rather than geologists.
Right.
So I was simply there as a companion and assistant to a surveyor to start with.
So you were getting what geology you could?
Yes, which happened to be very little, in fact. Because they were always wanting to be at the top of topographical bits of high ground, which were usually enveloped in cloud and not much good from the geological point of view. So it was a bit frustrating from that point of view.
Geologists prefer the bottoms of mountains rather than the tops.
Well, they prefer places where they can see and get at the rocks, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And that is more often below the cloud base anyway, and in terrain that's, well, we had to travel in all sorts of terrain, but normally we didn't take undue risks and go to places that offered, were too difficult from the access point of view.
In that first year, then, you didn't have the clout to decide where the dogs would go. You didn't have sufficient clout as a new man to say, I want to go to see so-and-so spot.
Not on the first journey, no.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but after that, then I went where I felt I had to go. Yes.
So once you'd acquired the field skills...
Yes, that's right,
could then
yes.
Pick up a GA.
If you like, the first journey was training in the techniques of Antarctic survival and so on. Mm. Yeah. And then I mean, one still had to adapt to collaborate with other people who were doing other things other than geology. But more and more, geology was the main purpose of the journeys, and I was able to concentrate on that aspect.
And you were the geologist, or was there more than one?
I was one of two. Yeah, the other one was Phil Nelson. And Phil and I got on quite well. We started out by being landed on the island of South Georgia, as a sort of acclimatizing trip for 6 weeks. And that was a marvellous experience because South Georgia is a very, very scenic and interesting island with deep fjords and glaciers coming down into the fjords. And it's what the west coast of Norway or even the west of Scotland must have looked like during the Ice Age. And we had a very good 6 weeks there looking at geology and camping and tentatively putting our feet on the glaciers and this sort of thing. So that was good, a good start.
So what kind of things were you coming up with when you got your hammer out to collect specimens? What were you finding?
Oh, you want some details of the actual geology?
Of course, you're a geologist, aren't you?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, on South Georgia, the rocks are highly folded, thinly bedded rocks called greywacke, sandstones and shales. And it was really a matter of trying to work out the structure of these rocks. And it was all, you know, very much new country, the sort of geology that I certainly hadn't encountered before. So it wasn't easy, but we did what we could, and then.
Did you analyse the rocks at the time, or
did no? No, we just collected samples. Yes.
So you were able to do some sort of estimate as to what they might be.
Oh yes. We had sufficient knowledge to identify the rocks in as a, and also you know the work of previous geologists who'd been there. We weren't the first. To work on South Georgia.
Were there any surprises?
I can't remember any surprises, I must say. But there must have been, I'm
fossils?
Sure.
Fossils?
The fossils were disappointing. We, obviously that was one of our main searches, was to try and find fossils. But we only found rather poor impressions of creatures in the rocks, no nice ammonites or anything like that.
Was it different at Hope Bay, on the Hope Bay runs?
Well, Hope Bay was, if anything, the same, yeah. Clearly, there are, on Mount Flora at Hope Bay, very famous, world-famous fossil beds with these lovely, well-preserved Jurassic plants in them. But that had all been collected and done way back in, to start with, in 1903, I think. So that was not something that we could do any original work in. And in any case, I said my job was to explore the ground well away from Hope Bay, well to the south, and see what was there. And of course, it's this process of finding out what is there, which is the exciting thing. Yeah.
And again, what kind of things were you discovering?
Again, I was finding these highly folded sandstones and shales, the sandstones called greywackies. But these were intruded by igneous rocks, by granites. And so there was always a variety of both igneous rocks and these sedimentary rocks, these highly folded sedimentary rocks. Round the granites. Offshore on James Ross Island, there were much younger volcanic rocks, but those were being studied by, as I say, my companion Phil Nelson. So we each had our own separate areas to work on and didn't really mix much as far as our work was concerned.
Any fossils found south of Hope Bay, any good finds?
No, as I say, there were rather scrappy fossils that you could just about make out had been some sort of organic beastie, but no, they were called trace fossils. In other words, the traces that these creatures had made whilst burrowing in the sand and in the mud, but no actual remains of the creatures themselves in terms of a shell or a carapace or whatever. They were in the younger rocks that were mostly cropping out in areas that I wasn't. They'd already been looked at, basically. So I had this these rocks that were somewhat monotonous, I have to say, because they went on for outcrop after outcrop, looking rather the same. And but as I say, my job was to find out what was there, and one never knew until one got to the outcrop what it was going to be.
When did you come back and work on your samples back in the UK?
Yes.
At Birmingham?
At Birmingham University, continuing under Ray Ady. And we obviously examined the rocks and had thin sections cut and sometimes chemical analyses. So I was able to write a fit scientific report on what I'd done, and that was substantially also my PhD thesis. So I was very fortunate in having done enough work whilst in the Antarctic to enable me to get a PhD out of it, and which was very useful in my subsequent career with the British Geological Survey.
Apart from a very nice PhD, why was the work important? I mean, why was it important to know what was there?
Well, that's a very profound question. I think it's there just might be something of economic value there, which it was a bit of territory after all that that the United Kingdom claimed. But of course, it was also territory that the Argentinians and the Chileans claimed, the same bit of ground. And I think it was perhaps in retrospect just as well we didn't find anything that was of mineral value there, because this would have inevitably, I think, increased the international tension and the dispute over the territory. So as it was, we found nothing of value. So it was pure science in that respect. It was just geology, just to find out what was there and describe it.
There was never any hint to you that you should, if you did find something worthwhile, you should keep it under your hat?
Yes. Oh, yes. I think we'd signed the Official Secrets Act.
Right.
I think, before we went down there. And that was always the case, that had we found anything of value, it would have been the governor of the Falkland Islands would have been the first to hear about it, I think.
This territorial business, I presume, I mean, one or two of the FIDs have suggested that mapping it, okay, it was great to map the territory, but actually by mapping the territory, geologically or geographically, you were strengthening your claim.
Yes, I think that's probably true. clearly, it was valuable to have an accurate topographical map of the territory you're claiming, and if that has your country's stamp on it, then it must add, I think, to the validity of your claim, and geology likewise. the other base, the Argentinians and Chileans, also had their geologists, but we didn't really get the impression that their work, I suppose it was possibly national pride, quite matched our own. But in retrospect, they did make a valuable contribution by doing bits of ground in much greater detail than our more reconnaissance type survey enabled us to do. Although I can't really quote chapter and verse on that.
There was no working together?
Not physically, no. In fact, I can't really remember a geologist as such. The Argentinian base, which was near our base at Hope Bay, was largely staffed by military personnel. Although, of course, they weren't allowed to carry out any military exercises because that was forbidden by the Antarctic Treaty, which they were signatories to. But they were very much a military base with all the command structure and everything else that goes with it.
So looking back at what you achieved in those two years, is it valuable in retrospect? Was it a valuable thing to do?
Not commercially valuable, I don't think.
But scientifically?
But scientifically, yes. I think any knowledge of what's what rocks are in the Earth's crust is scientifically valuable, even if it's sort of proving a negative, as it were. Yes.
Let's talk a bit more about the process of being in the field then, because once you've done your training trip, so to speak, with Chris,
yes,
you were then off, presumably with somebody else. You weren't going as one man.
No, well, you've probably heard that at Hope Bay, it was primarily a weather station.
Well, it was for a while, wasn't it?
With six meteorologists, because they had to take readings every 3 hours all through the night and day, even in the middle of winter. And they decided that the weather at Hope Bay was so completely atypical of the region as a whole, you've probably heard this, that weather readings were of no value in giving the regional picture. So all these meteorologists were made redundant as meteorologists and turned into general assistants. Dog drivers, much to their delight, of course, because it's far nicer going out in the field and driving a dog team than sitting on base taking weather readings every 3 hours. So we had a very happy and satisfied bunch of ex-meteorologists to accompany
us. So you're never short of travel companions.
That's right, yes, yeah, yes.
So talk me through a classic geological survey or geological trip.
Right, well, we usually had to travel for a day or two before we got to the area that I was going to geologically survey. So it was always that trip across the peninsula to the Prince Gustav Channel, which was a nice limbering up exercise, if you like. It got you a bit fitter and acclimatized to camping and so on, before reaching the area where the geological work was going to start. And then we'd find a suitable site as near as possible to the outcrops that I was going to examine. And that was sometimes a bit tricky, because finding sheltered campsites which are not prone to difficult crevasse conditions or sea ice breaking up and floating away or this sort of thing. It was always, we were somewhat reliant on the experience of the people we were travelling with, especially in my first year, of course. So we'd find a suitable spot to pitch a tent, which I would suggest was an area where I could easily go out with an empty sledge during the day and do my work, come back to in the evening, and perhaps spend 2 or 3 weeks at such a site. of course, we always took a small pup tent, as we called it, and our sleeping bags and emergency rations in case we were trapped away from our main tent. And this did happen on one or two occasions. so that was the general picture that I worked from these temporary tents, temporary camps, and then moved on when I'd finished mapping a given area.
So you had one tent, which was your base tent?
Yes, right. Yes.
And did the GA stay there, or did he come with you?
Oh, he usually came with me, yes, yes.
And then he had a satellite.
So it was always important to have two people on, and often sometimes three, because if you had two sledges, then if one sledge went down a crevasse, there was the other one to pull you out. And as I was working, you know, up all sorts of inland terrain, not just easy, safe terrain. It was quite important to have two sledges usually, and in one or two occasions that proved necessary. But on the sea ice, which I did to start with, I think I was just accompanying a surveyor, and I'm trying to remember why I was on the sea ice. Certainly, that was one of the more frightening experiences of my sledging career.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, we camped on this sea ice in between some of the islands and the Gustav Channel. And I was aware that some perhaps 10, 15 miles away there was open water. And I was also aware that sea ice was fragile, that it could break up if a big swell got up out at sea, or if a wind got up. And in the middle of the night, you're camping there and a wind gets up and you begin to imagine the worst sort of thing. And it's quite difficult to control one's fears, I found, in those circumstances, and not say we'd better get out of here quick sort of thing. But of course, people you're with were used to this sort of situation and had long ago either learned to suppress these fears or didn't actually hold those fears. So that was an early experience of camping. Yeah.
Why were you camping on the sea ice in the first place? I thought that was a cardinal sin.
I think it was it was probably because we were amongst these islands where they dropped sheer into the sea. There was very little place to pitch a tent. And I suppose it's also the fact that these people were pretty confident that the sea ice was really fast, that it was there for many months and wouldn't break up and go out. I know in one case we were only within, we camped because we couldn't get ashore because the tide was out. And when the sea ice, of course, goes up and down with the tide, like the floor of a lift. And when the tide is out, you've got this cliff of ice between you and the land. And it's often very difficult to actually climb up this cliff with a heavily laden dog sledge and so on. It requires ice climbing and so on. So we often found it easier to camp on that, on the sea ice, wait for the tide to rise until we could easily get ashore onto the land.
We're talking about several feet, are we?
Yes, oh yes. Sort of 4 or 5 feet, yeah.
So camping on sea ice was common practice in the late 50s,
yes.
Early 60s?
Yes, I think so.
I think it went out of fashion after the horseshoe.
Well, we always felt that our sea ice was a lot safer than over on the west coast, where it was open to the South Atlantic swell, really, there, whereas we were very sheltered amongst the James Ross Island and the other islands. And it's swell that tends to break up sea ice and causes it to be dangerous. And our sea ice tended not to be affected by that. So I think we weren't being too foolhardy in camping on sea ice.
But were risks taken seriously in those days? Health and safety discussed at length?
Well, the term health and safety hadn't appeared in anybody's vocabulary then.
Common sense.
Yes. Yes, but obviously we were aware of risks. Yes, we particularly falling down crevasses, I think, was the risk that most of us appreciated. And, of course, for this reason, we always used to have a rope attached to the handlebar of the sledge so that the sledge, of course, where the load was evenly distributed, would be far less likely to go down a crevasse than somebody going along running behind the sledge. And it was quite common for, when travelling up glaciers, for people to put their foot through a crevasse or even both feet and just sort of either haul themselves out by clinging to the back of the sledge or being pulled out by this rope attached to the sledge.
So crevasses were, generally speaking, not as wide as the sledge was long. They were narrower than the sledge.
Generally, the dangerous ones were. There were some that were wider than the sledge, but they usually had very large, slightly sagging snow bridges, which where the only actual hole, if you like, was at the very edge. And we used to probe these things before crossing them, probe them with the ice axe, just to reassure ourselves that we were probably safe to cross. But in extreme cases, we would, you know, go across and attach a rope and make sure that if the sledge did break through, it was attached by a rope to somebody. But mostly we relied on the fact that the sledge would, and the dogs, of course, are out in front, so they're the first to go down if the sledge, if the crevasse bridge is unsafe. And quite a few times we had to pull the dogs out of crevasses.
You never went down yourself? You never fell down yourself?
No, I put my legs through once or twice, but never my whole body.
There was, of course, a famous event in which Ian Hampton was injured. And, I don't think you were on the spot at the time, were you?
I wasn't on the spot, but I was on base. I was at a place called Viewpoint, which is one of the subsidiary huts. So I was very much involved in passing messages backwards and forwards from Neil Orr, the doctor and base leader, who was up on a faraway glacier. And it was imperative to get a message to him and to get him to come and attend to Ian.
Can you talk me through the incident from your viewpoint then?
Viewpoint. Well, obviously, we heard it all on the radio, and we were anxious to help to find Neil Orr and get a message to him. I think we went out to search for him. I'm not too clear my memory about this. For Neil Orr, yes.
A search party was sent in.
Yes, yeah. And when he eventually got to Viewpoint, we were able to help him on his way further down the channel. I remember one of the embarrassing things was that this is a story against myself, was that I sent him off. I told him what the compass bearing was. To set off down the channel because it was pretty manky, pretty foggy at times. And to my great shame, when I told him this compass bearing, instead of subtracting the magnetic variation, I added it, which meant he was about 20 degrees off course had he taken any notice of my compass bearing. But fortunately, and it would have taken him into a nasty bit of flooded sea ice, in fact, which would have been a bit dangerous. But I think fortunately he relied on his own guidance in where he went. But it was looking back, I was a bit horrified at this mistake I'd made.
How did you realise you'd made the mistake?
I think pretty soon after he'd...
After he'd
gone, yes.
There was no question of chasing after him.
I think we did, actually. Yes, I think we did, but failed to catch up with him or find him.
So you were listening to the radio as all this was going on.
Yes.
Amongst the Hope Bay team that year, at that point, was there a real fear that Ian would not come back?
I don't think we were aware of that extreme. No, I think we realised he'd been injured, but was able to communicate, and it was really a matter of it was encouraging to know that the doctor was on his way. So I think one accepted that, yeah.
You were confident?
Yes.
There was a sense of confidence?
Yes.
Yeah. How was he when you saw him, Ian?
I think he was in a pretty poor state, yeah. Clearly, he'd had this injury to his scalp, which required all these stitches, and as far as I can remember, he was grinning and bearing it, which was encouraging, but it's always a nasty moment when one's companions get injured like that.
Yeah. He required an X-ray, didn't he? And the base didn't have an X-ray machine.
Yes. So he was taken down to the Argentinian base, I think. Or was he taken onto a ship?
No, it was the Argentinian
base. It was the Argentinian base.
You didn't go with him?
No. If you remember, I was the next year after Ian, so I wasn't one of his contemporaries, who were obviously at the forefront of looking after him.
Did you have any medical problems yourself?
No, not really. Nothing.
Septic toe?
Is that in the record?
You must have said it to Amanda.
Oh, right. Yes, well, there we are. I seem to remember having on base having to have penicillin injections in my bum, but which was presumably for that incapacity. Yes, but otherwise I was pretty fit, fortunately. Yeah.
How did you cope with the layups in the Mankey weather then? Because all right, you had books to read, but. Books, okay, for a while, isn't it? Were there other things you could do to keep past the time?
Well, this is where I must take my hat off to people I was with, who were almost invariably good companions and sometimes very, very good talkers. I'm not much of a talker myself, but some people I remember were, you know, had endless amusing anecdotes to tell and were very good companions from that point of view. John Wynnum, for example, was who I'd known in Newcastle before I went down. So he was an old friend as well as a companion there.
Was that sheer coincidence, or had you applied together?
No, sheer coincidence. Yes, yes.
You listened to Spanish radio.
Yes, yes. We tuned into anything that we could easily pick up on the old 68 sets. Which weren't much use, really. But
sorry, 68 sets?
Yes.
What are they?
Well, they're big ex-army radio sets with, you know, hot valves and quite unlike anything that's used these days. Very heavy to carry.
But you've had them in the field.
And not reliable at all, because they used to, the hot valves used to freeze up and not work, basically. So we could, I suppose about half the time we could use them to communicate, usually by Morse code. And on rare occasions we could actually speak to base with them, but they weren't very good radios at all.
But you could pick up Spanish stations?
Yes.
From South America, presumably?
Yes, you could twiddle about with the knobs and eventually find one or two Spanish stations from South America, yes, usually commercial radio, of course. We could also pick up South African radio, which was usually a bit more interesting because it played more familiar tunes and things and gave news of the English-speaking world, shall we say. And on rare occasions, pick up BBC overseas, of course. That was a real bonus when we could do that. So that was, we were always trying to do this, but not often succeeding.
Did you acquire any Spanish?
No, not just the odd word. I think some people were good at good at languages, and they made a point of mixing more with the Argentinians and learning Spanish and enjoying communicating with them, trying their Spanish out by speaking to the Argentinians. But I was usually too involved with my field work and and to feel any need to do that.
So you didn't spend much time yourself fraternising with the
Argentinian base? No. But I enjoyed the parties we occasionally had down there and the occasions when they came up and joined us. You know, it was a very good relationship between the two bases. And there was very little of the sort of animosity that had been there in the past.
Looking back now with almost 50 years hindsight, how does that period in your life rate compared to the rest of your life?
Oh, I think it was an experience which I was always be extremely grateful to have had, and I think I was very lucky in being able to have that experience. It was a high point of my life, my career, no doubt about it. Yeah. The rest of my career has been, I suppose, spent in Britain. So it was.
Well, you stay with the British Geological
Survey.
Yeah. Did you ever do anything quite as exciting as that ever again?
No. I mean, I was interested in the geology I was doing in the Peak District, and I was very lucky in that when I joined the BGS that they'd finished geologically surveying all the urban areas and the big industrial conurbations and so on, and they were starting to spread out into more remote but much pleasanter areas of the country, such as the Peak District, which was where I was to do most of my work, and North Lancashire as well. So again, I was very lucky in that part of my career. as well as the Antarctic bit at the beginning.
I'm just wondering about, because several chaps have said this, and I'm just wondering about what it's like to have the most exciting part of your life at the beginning of one's life, if you like. It's a bit like the Neil Armstrong moment, isn't it? What do you do when you come back from the moon?
Yes. Well, I didn't, I didn't sort of make invidious comparisons as to the life I was leading subsequent to my Antarctic experience. I mean, I was always able to, you know, to go on holiday to mountainous areas if I felt like it. My wife and I bought a timeshare at a ski resort in the Alps. So I always got my at least a week's in the snow and ice in the Alps in winter.
No penguins.
That was a little bit of a lingering substitute for the snow and ice of my early experience, and we still enjoy that. Yeah.
So the Antarctic experience was a great line in your CV, and maybe did it help your career, do you think?
Well, it's difficult for me to say that. I certainly didn't seem to have any problems with getting the next job after the Antarctic job, and in doing my subsequent work, so it must have had been a help in that respect rather than something that didn't matter. Yeah.
Have you been south since?
No. I've always felt that I've been there and done that, as far as going south is concerned. I think if somebody offered me a free trip, I would take it up immediately. But I feel, you know, there's so much more of the world to see, and I've only seen a very small part of it, even now. So, and I don't feel I could, repeat the wonderful experience I had when I did go down.